So if you just want to start off and say your name and...
My name is Nancy, middle initial J as in Jean, J-E-A-N, Dawson, D-A-W-S-O-N.
And where are you from? And what do you do?
I'm from Russellville, Kentucky. Well, that I live in Russellville, Kentucky. I've been in that region for about 20 years. I'm actually from a place called Quindaro, and that's in Kansas City, Kansas. Q-U-I-N-D-A-R-O. Quindaro was named after a Native American woman, Nancy Quindaro Guthrie Brown. And it's a town, it's an underground railroad town in which enslaved Africans crossed the Missouri River when it was frozen to live in Kansas, the free state. And that's important because that's an important part of my history. So I need to tell you that.
And so just curious, do you still have connections and ties to...
I go all the time.
In Kansas?
My family still lives here. Yes.
I see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I can never forget that place. Yes.
And what brought you to Kentucky?
Well, I left Quindaro. And that's what we call it, Quindaro, which is Kansas City, Kansas. When I went to University of Missouri, Kansas City. That's why I got my undergraduate degree in radio, television, mass communication. And from there, I went to New York, upstate New York, where I went to State University of New York, University of Albany. And I got a doctoral degree. I have two masters and a doctoral degree. One master's in African-American studies, and I have a doctoral degree in humanistic studies, specializing in curriculum and instruction in African American studies. And I have Master of Science in curriculum and instruction. So I left, like I said, the Quindaro area. I was born on the Kansas side, went to school on the Missouri side, and then I went to SUNY Albany for my master's and doctoral degree.
And so after you graduated, what happened?
Well, after I graduated, I started teaching. I worked under a teacher by the name of Vivian Verdell Garden. She was a noted black womanist scholar. And so I was her teaching assistant, and I became good at it. And so she was sick, and I took over the classroom, and I was very good at it. So I started teaching college. I started teaching college maybe 20, 21 years old. Mm-hmm. But my family in Quindaro historically had been farmers. And in fact, my father's people, Henry Dawson, that's my great-grandfather, Henry Dawson lived across the street from a man by the name of Julius Groves. Julius Groves was known, he worked with Booker T. Washington, and he was known as the Potato King. And he worked with, at that time, Booker T. Washington was organizing farmers all over the United States. And he grew more potatoes than anybody in America. And so my great-grandfather, who was in the Civil War, lived across the street from him. And I can prove, I've actually done the genealogical research, and I can show you a picture that shows that plot of land that my great-grandfather owned was right across from Julius Groves. Mm-hmm. So that's an important part of my farm story, which we'll talk about more later.
Yeah, so I guess moving into that, what drew you into farming? Because you were a professor, right? And you were...
Yeah. So after I received my doctoral degree, I went to my first... full-time, I was an adjunct professor for years in different places. So about 28 years old, I became an assistant professor of black studies at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale, Illinois. Why is that important? Because Carbondale is not that far from Russellville. It's not that far from Southern Illinois. It's 45 minutes from Paducah, Kentucky. So I've still been in this region. And so I taught there. And I taught African American studies, and I love it. But all the time that I was teaching African American studies, we never talked about black farming. We talked about ancient Egypt, we talked about other things, but not black farming. So after I left SIU, I moved into Clarksville, Tennessee, where I became director of African American Studies at Austin Peay State University, which is in Clarksville, Tennessee, which is 22 miles from Russellville, where I'm at now. So I've been in this area for quite some time. But once again, we didn't really refer to, even though I was teaching African American Studies, we didn't refer to the black farm. So when I, but as I went to, I left, as in Clarksville, I started working with Fort Donelson National Battlefield. I was a consultant for the, for Fort Donelson, which is the National Park Service. And I started to look at the role of Civil War soldiers. And in studying Civil War soldiers, I realized that most of these black soldiers in particular had been, they got out of slavery, got a plot of land, and became farmers. That's what my great-grandfather was, got a plot of land, got out of the Civil War. He, in fact, was in Nashville in the Civil War, and he got out, got a plot of land, and came to Kansas. So my family was, saw they were kind of in the same vein as most soldiers. So a lot of blacks who got land and started farming were first soldiers in the Civil War because they had been sold as farmers in slavery. So then they wanted their own piece of land. So we were always taught growing up in Kansas because my family owned that land. We still have connections with that land to this day. But we owned land, and it was very important for us to maintain the land. And so my parents would tell me that you need to maintain your land because your family has fought for this, and this means a lot. So we was always taught to have a respect for the land and to do what's necessary. Now, I, to be honest, didn't want to do that. You know, I became a professor. I was in New York. I wanted to be something altogether different. But the land slowly started to call to me because I got sick. And in getting sick, it was a necessity for me to get fresh foods. And so I wasn't really working at that time, and I realized that getting fresh foods was complicated. There was a lot, you know, just because getting a canned food, which is full of sodium, getting frozen foods, that's another whole story. But getting fresh foods, that was not easy on a limited budget. And so I thought the best thing I could do was start growing my own food because I knew how to do it because I grew up doing it. I didn't like it, but I knew how to do it. So I started growing a great container garden on my back porch of this house. And this house I live in Russellville was built in 1854, but it had been modernized. So I had container gardens all around the porch. And so I had peppers and tomatoes. And I had everything, and which was really simple to grow. And the neighborhood kids started coming to my back porch and looking at the things growing. And they were saying, like, what is that? I said, it's a pepper. Well, how you get that? And I was like, what? So what I quickly realized is that the children in the neighborhood didn't know how things grew. They didn't know how tomatoes grew. They didn't know how pepper. They didn't know anything. So I went to the extension office and I said, I want a community garden. Well, they laughed at me. And so, you know, I went back. And so finally I got somebody's attention and I started a project and I got people together and I created the name, the Russellville Urban Gardening Project. Because although we were in a very rural area, we were still urban. Because they hadn't, if you know by Logan County, Russellville is the city. And then the county is all these other little very, very rural areas. But the people in the county didn't necessarily connect with those poor kind of urban kids in the city. So that's why I call the Russellville Urban Gardening Project, because many people ask why urban to this day, because they're urban kids.
Yeah, it's in the city.
Yeah. Even though you can go 5 miles and you're in a rural area, but that's how it works. And so I realized that the same issues that the rural kids in the rural kids and urban kids didn't have an understanding of certain things. So whereas you had some of the rural kids who were in FFA, well, the city kids, the ones in Russellville, didn't have access to the Future Farmers of America. They didn't even know the extension office existed. So, like I said, I created a community garden to teach. And so I started doing, had raised beds. That's how I started. And I started growing simple things, little herbs, tomatoes, onions. And so I started getting the young people in it. I took them to 4-H. I started a 4-H group. And so I started taking them to, bringing them up to like Louisville to participate in the state fair. They had never done that. One boy, he was going up and down the escalators in the state fair office over there. And he said, you know, he's 18, 19 now, but he had never been on an escalator. So, you know, I stick with it, and I start expanding and doing more and more with the farm. And at that time, people weren't doing urban farms. You know, I started doing for urban farms many years ago, where urban farm wasn't popular. Now it's popular. But at that time, it wasn't. People was laughing at me because traditional farmers didn't understand it. And then the people in the city didn't understand it. But if you look in history, particularly African-American populations, it was always people that had a few chickens who had was growing stuff in their yards. That's not really, it's not new. It just wasn't called urban farming. You see, one time I wrote an article talking about, I call it like gardening for engagement, because that's what you're doing. Because you urban farmers engage the community, getting them involved in talking about what they do, you know. So I started to do that, engage in the community. Now, it's been a struggle. It hasn't been easy. Because, like I said, you have a lot of people in the urban area who don't want to farm because farming was slavery. You got to understand that, and that's many African-American populations think that way. Farming is not seen as something good. It's something that was slavery because you didn't own the means of what you were growing. You didn't, it was, you know, you didn't own it. You just was out there working, but you didn't own it. So, you know, I started to, and I found that some vegetables that were, like I would, certain regions like Russellville, people tend to eat purple top turnips. They don't eat collards. They don't eat mustard. Where I grew up, we ate them all in cans. We mixed them. But they didn't do that. So, if you were growing something and the people are not familiar with it, they don't eat it. So then I started having to break off into doing nutrition and teaching people how to eat certain things. So, for example, I was growing mustard, and they were saying, the mustard is bitter. Well, mustard is bitter. They didn't understand. So I had to teach them about eating this kind of stuff. So I started doing educational programs. I started doing farm-to-table dinners. I started bringing chefs. So it became a lot to get people in it. But there's a lot of issues that happen with urban farms. Just because urban farms, people think should be like well manicured, like a park.
Right.
But farms are not well manicured, so that was a problem. So I had to deal with the problem of cutting grass. It's a lot of issues. People coming and taking what they want without working. That's a problem.
Yeah.
So I had to overcome all those things. I started working with Kentucky State University. And I got working with the School of Agriculture. And I have a grant with them. In fact, I do a lot of projects with them. I do all kind of educational projects with them. Now, almost 10 years after I started the Russellville Urban Gardening Project, I have a co-op, and it's called Ag First. I started working with Ag First in Georgia, but with a man by the name of Ricky Donaldson. And I worked in Georgia doing stuff with farmers, large-scale row crop farmers, large-scale farmers. And so we finally took the concept to Kentucky, and that's how we got Ag First of Kentucky. It is a legal organization. So it's Ag First in Georgia, and it's Ag First in Kentucky. And the Ag First of Kentucky, we have all kind of farmers. We have them in Todd County, Meade County, all over the state, African-American farmers. Why do we need a co-op? Because we need to share resources. We need the resources, i.e. equipment. That's a problem with a lot of small farmers. Equipment. Workers is an issue. Processing. It's just a lot of issues. So Ag First is where I'm at. Now, I still have Russellville Urban Gardening Project, but I'm a part of a collective. So I'll let you, I think I talked a lot. So.
No, that's perfect. That's mm-hmm. good. So the Russellville Urban Gardening Project, is that, give me a visual, how large is it? How many people contribute to it?
Russellville Urban Gardening Project is consistent of about 4 acres. It's in the middle of the town. We have high tunnels. We have raised beds. And then we have just more traditional kind of planting of things. We use black plastic culture. It's more really of a demonstration farm because people come from other places. Like I had people come from California, New York, who just, I had a group of people come in and I had sweet potatoes and they had never dug a sweet potato or any kind of potato. So sometimes we just do simple stuff like that. Just showing people, city people, about growing things.
And do other people who work the farm every day? Or is it
sometimes I have kids. This year I had kids working the farm. Sometimes I have women working the farm. It just depends. It's hard. Workers are hard to find. So it's what you can come up with, what kind of group you can come with. This year I'll do another. The children's program was very successful, and I think I'll do that again. Like I said, K-State has given me a grant to help me get farm workers to try to come in. But it's still hard because most of the people, if you want farm workers, you got to also have places for them to stay.
Right.
So that's a little bit, that's a little difficult.
Is there a place like that?
Well, that's what we're working on.
Oh, I see.
That's the next step. We're working on fencing, and we're working on some places where people can stay. What I want to do is have a place where people can come, from Louisville, from Lexington. You want to come down for a week or two, you can work with us and we can show you things, and you can work the farm and stay down there. So I'm moving more. I'm going back to my educational background. So I'm moving more toward an educational component.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Have you worked with AmeriCorps? Because I know they would probably.
I have. I'm going to consider that this year. It's a lot of art. It's another one. I can't think of the name of several of them because now that urban farming is in vogue.
Right. Yeah.
It's a lot of these things. But like I said, I've been doing this a long time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, people are just now catching up to the idea that, you can actually grow food inside the city and have it be sustainable and good and everything.
And people still haven't caught on to the fact that people will pay to learn how to grow food. Mm-hmm. And just like I was I'm an educator now, teaching people how to. Like, for example, this little boy, I had him digging potatoes, and he told me, we can't eat the potatoes because they're dirty. So I'm like, well, where did French fries come from? He had no concept. He didn't make any connection. Something's wrong with that. So that's why an educational component, I think, is good. So that you can figure that out.
Yeah. That was going to be my next question, about how, you mentioned a lot of challenges. How are you meeting, or how are you tackling those challenges? You said, so through education is a big one?
Well, education is how you have to do it.
Yeah.
Whereas I chose not to do farming as a child, but I knew it. Because they taught us how to grow stuff. But as a lot of young people now don't have any idea. They just go to Walmart. And Walmart is the farm. Walmart is where they get their food. And that's kind of scary. Especially when, like, herbs cost so much money. Herbs are so easy to grow. But part of that is is capitalism and how the system operates. So you become dependent on Walmart and not dependent on yourself.
Right. So expand on that a little bit. I'm very curious. The fact that we live in a capitalist system in which, you know, things are commodified and like how do we still kind of create communities that will care about farming? Because, I mean, if it is cheaper to go to Walmart, how do you get people to care? You know what I mean?
Because when you go to your local farmer, you know what's in the food. Like, for example, there's no black organic farmers in the state of Kentucky as of the date of this interview. I'm trying to be the first black organic farmer. There is none.
Really?
No, not one. Why is that? Because organic farming is labor intensive. I don't spray chemicals. Some of that food you're getting in some of these stores, you don't know what's been on it. You don't know who sprayed. You don't know the story of the worker and has the worker been exploited. You don't know what has happened to the food. What chemicals have been sprayed on food. You don't know that. So I think as people become more educated about what they put in their bodies, I think I know I have some sicknesses, and a lot of it has to do with, it's hereditary, but it has to do with what you eat. So I think when people, younger generations, are more educated about that, it will change, and they will be looking. For example, we have eggs. I have Americana birds. They're chickens. Americanas produce a green egg, sometimes pink. People don't want it.
Just don't think green eggs are appetizing.
Exactly.
You know.
Well, but the egg is, the shell is just green.
It's just the shell.
And we know exactly where that chicken is. We know what the chicken is eating because we're feeding it.
So it seems like a lot of it requires just time, you know, changing minds and people being educated.
And I think you have, especially since the USDA has accepted urban farming and things, we have a change. You have a lot of people that's very serious. And then you have the struggle of ugly food. Most, like tomato, like Cherokee purples. You ever heard of Cherokee tomatoes?
Oh, yeah.
Cherokee tomatoes are ugly. So, you know, some people look at them, look at that tomato, it's big and ugly, and it's, you know, and I love them.
Yeah.
So it's when people started to eat, you know, only from the grocery store, and they wanted a very pretty vegetable or pretty fruit. And so you have to do a lot of changing of the mindset to get them to eat something different. They don't even know that there's a lot of varieties of tomatoes. We only see two or three of them.
Right. A lot of people never even tasted an heirloom tomato.
They don't know what that is.
It's magic. That's what it is. It's
and beautiful. Then sweet, the concept of sweet corn, you know, you have a lot of things around, you know, genetic modification, all that kind. It's so much to this because it's about money, and certain people make certain money, and you make money by doing certain things, and you don't make money by people feel by doing other things. But the more people learn that what you put in your body makes a difference. Because, you know, younger generations are concerned with their bodies. You know, so if you can go to the gym all day long, if you're eating the wrong thing, it's not going to help.
True.
So, it makes a difference.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I also notice younger generations tend to be, are more critical of capitalism, you know, now. Mm-hmm. Than never before, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if that would lead to a structural change. Like, if we will have an economy that's not solely dependent on profit, where, you know, maybe health outcome would be important just as much as profit is. Is that part of your goal, is to kind of like make some structural changes like that, or is it?
My goal is to get people to eat so they'll feel better the right way and learn how to feed themselves. Every group needs to know how to feed themselves. If you choose to go to Walmart, that's one thing. I mean, I go to Walmart, but you still have to, but I know how. If I had to do something different, I could survive. That's important. That's educational. It's just like teaching them about college. Everything you learn in school, you don't use. But universities have a curriculum set around what students should know, and how to eat is something they should know. How to grow food is something they should know. And not only that, I'm working on not only food, but there's other aspects like this. These are from alpacas. I've been dealing with alpacas. I'm going to start raising them. I've been, look on your face, is worth a thousand.
Like, what is this?
Booties from alpaca.
Oh, nice.
What we did was we sheared the alpacas. I had it processed. And so here's some of the little booties. So that's all natural wood.
Wow.
Wool.
And y'all raise alpacas out there too?
I'm working on getting them sheared and working with some other farmers. I have to get my fencing and all that together. That's all the alpaca.
Wow. Mm-hmm. So soft.
It's right, because some people, a lot of the things we're wearing is made from synthetics and stuff that's not good for you. So I'm even dealing with that now. Value added.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. So I'm getting ready to try to figure out how to market those to sell. And we're trying to get, these African-American women have been making these things. So I'm also an artisan, so we're doing things to work on trying to find some unique stuff to make. I don't know, as of this interview, we haven't quite figured out what would be good, but we're working on it. Hmm. So I had these in my purse to show people these examples.
I see.
And to find out what would people buy. Because farming is a lot of stuff. It's more than just fruits and vegetables.
Yeah. Mm. You know, little baby shoes.
Mm. Right. Right. Man, that's pure alpaca. No other stuff in it.
Wow.
And the fact is not dying.
There's no dye?
You don't, is it? No, you can dye it. But this is, you know, alpacas can be, the ideal alpaca is white. So that you can dye it. But this one was a little black alpaca. So it wasn't dyed at all.
I see.
So yeah, you can dye it. Mm-hmm. But you don't have to.
Yeah.
Like I said, people don't even think about this. So this is one of my new ventures. Making stuff from alpacas. So I got a box of from llamas and alpacas that I had processed. Because a lot of people have these animals and they don't have herds. They just have a few. So they don't even want, they just shear them, but they don't really want. You have to shear them, because if you keep the fur on, they'll die. You got to shear them. It keeps them cool and all that. So you need to do it yearly. If you don't, it's not good for the animal. So a lot of them don't process it. Well, I'm saying, well, so I've made some negotiations with some of those people. And so I'm processing, and now I'm beginning to figure out what to make.
I see.
Mm-hmm. So.
And so for the purposes of the audio, like, could you say, like, what you were holding earlier? Like,
this is just it's, you know, alpacas, it's a wool, like lambs is wool. But, you know, alpaca is like cashmere. So it's a high scale. So this is like a necklace, like a little rope that you could wear. And then I had some booties that I showed you. Mm-hmm. So I'm beginning to do other aspects of farming. I'm beginning to deal in. I have some chickens this year. This is the first time I've ever done that. So I'm doing more than just now vegetables. I'm beginning to do other things. And this is, like I said, pure alpaca.
Very cool. Mm-hmm. I'd be down to buy some. You know, I would buy
what do you think what people will want?
That's a good question. I think my mom does a lot of knitting and crocheting, so she'd probably just want like a yarn, like a thing of yarn, so she could do her own stuff.
Well, ask her, because I can maybe send her some, I'll send her some, like, examples.
Okay.
And maybe she, because I'm trying to find, because I had this choker I wanted to create, but the choker was created from yarn, which is cotton. Mm-hmm. Wool is different. It lays different. Because wool doesn't lay. It lays different than cotton does. So that didn't work.
I see.
Mm-hmm. And so I'm experimenting. Like I said, it costs a lot of money to process it. So this is experimental. But I'll eventually find the right, because a whole garment, if you made a sweater, that's a lot of money. And a person would have to pay a lot to get buy a cashmere sweater. So I'm trying to find something that's small enough. You know, that the average, once again, I'm worrying about, because other than that, if it just becomes something for only the elite to have, that's not good. And so I don't want that. I'm trying to get somewhere average people could afford it. I always think like that.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Want it to be accessible.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. So I want something that, if it, you know, alpaca is no, you know, it's like, wow, I'm wearing alpaca. Okay, well, let's, well, how come average women can't wear alpaca?
Right. Good point.
So I got chickens this year, and I'm beginning to work with alpaca. So now we're moving from just vegetables, and I got fruit trees. And I have a problem with the fruit trees because people take the I have a cherry tree. And when I like to let stuff, because, you know, stay on the vine until it's ripe. Even tomatoes, I like that way because they taste better. And in our system, we tend to get things not ripe so they can have a longer shelf life. But that's not the best taste. So that's another point back to your other question about how this would be good for farmers and how it would be good for people. Because if you never had a vine ripened heirloom tomato, come on.
Yeah, they're
missing out. And when I go back and think it, that's part of the reason I think I started doing farming, because I grew up where I knew what that stuff tasted like. And then when it got to the point where this is not tasting this way, the tomatoes are not the same. The peppers are not the same. The onions are not the same. So that's what it drove me to. When I think about it, that taste. Because when we were kids, we'd go to the farmer's market. Or we grew it. So I know the taste. Even a potato. It tastes different. Mm-hmm.
Do you, if I can stop this. There it goes. Well, my other questions were, I kind of want to go back to something you said a little bit ago. You felt like the land was calling you. Because one of my questions was also, what is your connection to the land? What do you feel like? You said that was calling you. Is that a spiritual?
Land is spiritual. And most cultures understand the spiritual connection to land. Okay. This particular culture, I mean United States culture, and I say that the United States, meaning just Western culture, has disconnected itself from the land. The Africans, Native Americans, many Latino groups, they all understand that. But that's why we're having all these climate problems. You know, because people don't understand and respect the land. We're in a climate crisis. You don't need the federal government to tell you that. Like, for example, sometimes I can start in February, and sometimes it's not. This year was May, because the weather is just different. My mother and father could predict stuff by looking outside. They used the Farmer's Almanac to tell things. They cut you even cut your hair by the almanac. You did everything by that, by the sun, by the moon. Okay, so people don't think, they call that voodoo hoodoo now. They don't think do all that. They don't connect. They don't see themselves as they are above or not a part of the land. The land was created by God, and I believe that. And people don't see that. They just disconnected from that, and that's a problem. And it's catching up with us.
How does that tie into climate change, you were saying?
Because the climate, when you don't treat the land right, it can come back and bite you. And that's what's happening. So people are not respecting the land. I mean, for example, let me try to give you some examples. When I grew up, certain food you didn't eat at a certain time because it just wasn't ripe. It's not. It doesn't grow at this time of the year. What food now? You can get anything any time of the year. Because that's why it's picked green. Like you get bananas, they're green. Because they come in, and you know, I was in places like Honduras. I know people died in those banana plantations, you know, to send you these green bananas. And they're green, so they'll turn eventually, you know, be ripe. So if it's a certain time of year, it's certain things you didn't eat. Even certain animals you didn't eat at a certain time of the year. Because it's just that they don't, not in that season. Like apples, this is apple season. But now we get that, we have any kind of apple you want all year round. So what does that mean? That means you're getting it from somewhere else and it's not necessarily ripe. So that impacts, yes, that is a problem with the climate. Because you're eating things when normally, that was the beauty of certain festivals, you know, fall festival. You eat things that come out in the fall, summer. You eat things that are ripe in the summer. We don't do that no more. We want to go to the store and get anything we want, anytime we want. There's a price to pay for that.
What do you think is the solution? Like seasonal eating more, or
you have to eat in harmony with the universe, and when things are ripe, you know. That and small farmers can do that. Large scale farmers, if you have thousands of acres of land that you're trying to produce things, you can't do all these things. And not, you see, the ultimate for many people is to make a profit. Well, at what expense?
Right. Have you noticed anything, you've been farming along since you were little. Have you noticed anything different? Like, what's changed with the climate?
The weather is different. Like I say, it's not as predictable. One, like I said, people, it's not predictable. It doesn't taste, the food doesn't taste the same as when I was a little girl. That is no, like I said, tomatoes, the tomatoes I grow do, but the tomatoes I get in the store don't. Strawberries, the fruits, no. Things don't taste the same. It's not as predictable in terms of when the season's going to start. That's all climate. And what you put in your body makes a difference to how your body functions.
Yeah.
So a lot of the ailments that people have is because of the food. And then if you're putting all kind of pesticides and all this stuff on the food, that makes a difference. If it's in the water, it makes a difference. And overall, there's a disrespect in all. Human beings don't see themselves, they see themselves as superior to the land and to the earth and not one with it. And COVID taught us something right there. You know, people thought that, you know, but a disease can come and knock everybody down.
Very true. Do you think, how would that affect the community that you've seen? Like, you know, it's affecting the food, doesn't taste the same. What about
because the people, what happens is younger people don't know how things taste. So if you get used to eating processed food, that's what you think all food should taste like. Like the girl who said, well, mustard is bitter. It's not even logical. So she don't know. And this was a really, it was super, it was naturally grown, it was beautiful mustard. And it was just really a perfect mustard. She didn't even understand that. The boy who said the potato was dirty. All potatoes are dirty in the beginning. That's you just, all fruits and veggies, you wash them. He didn't even understand that.
Yeah.
That's scary.
Right.
Mm. I've even, working with chefs, I've worked with many major chefs. People who have been chop champions, I mean major chefs. And they didn't even know, like, when you get a fresh egg, how you supposed to, you got to wash it and all. They don't even know how to, they don't even know how to deal with it. They don't know how to deal with certain, because we're so used to processed foods, we don't even know how to cook or prepare things that are not like that. So you don't know what it tastes like. You don't know how to prepare it. It's scary.
Yeah.
It's scary. So that's why I have really devoted Russellville Urban Gardening Project to teaching people. As I've always been a teacher. And if you're looking at the African-American experience, it started with farming. We were brought here as enslaved Africans to work plantations, farming, right? And how is it that I was a professor of Black Studies and that's not really, I didn't even understand that.
Yeah, how is it that that history's been obscured from people? Why, in your opinion?
For example, I'm doing a project now about black jockeys. Between 1875 and 1901, the jockeys that run the Kentucky Derby were African American. Well, that makes sense because they were what? They were equestrians. They were doing this kind of stuff on the plantation. Okay? Makes sense. But why is it that people don't know that? I'm sitting here doing this interview with you in Louisville, Kentucky. And if you go out and ask most people, they don't know that the first jockeys to win the Kentucky Derby were black. How is that?
Right.
What happened? Kentucky has a lot of its wealth has been in what? Alcohol, horse racing. Those were things slaves did. Many of the brews, period, brews, liquor, drinks, famous drinks, the slaves created them. Why don't we know that?
Yeah.
So when you start looking into farming, you're going to get into slavery. You're going to get into economic. You're going to get into a lot of things. And I think that's why that's been obscured from the history.
Yeah, like a lot of people don't know, what's the name of the bourbon maker? Is it Jim Beam or that, where the recipe was made by an enslaved black man, you know?
Yes.
He wrote the recipe.
On the Tennessee side, it's called, I know the one, it's a black woman who, Uncle Nurse. Yeah, I know that woman. She, the reason why is because she couldn't get them to produce a liquor, so she, you know, created herself from the recipe from the enslaved Africans. Uncle Nearest, which, by the way, I bought me some Uncle Nearest because I'm not a drinker, but as a keepsake. But blacks did a lot of brewing liquor and stuff. My family, they did that in the old days. I remember as a kid seeing stuff and didn't understand that was a steal.
Any of that knowledge get passed on to you about how to do stuff?
Well, but I have an interest in going into fermentation. Because when you get off into farming, what happens is you start to see farming is like a packer. That you would never think of that, would you? It starts to open your eyes to how much of the economy is built on farming. Because everybody has to eat. Everybody has to wear stuff. Everybody, you know, drinking is a part of it. Artificial turf, that's farming. It starts like, wow. So that's what I'm doing. I'm at a wow level and I'm doing different things. Because farming is a lot of things. And farming is why the enslaved Africans were brought here in the first place. So really, African American studies and farming is a perfect match. Because that's it started.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that attitudes among African American population, at least that you've interacted with, do you think attitudes are changing? People are coming around to farming as a good thing?
I think just people in Americans, younger people in general, are coming around with farming.
Yeah,
and it's a lot of young African Americans. It's just a lot of young people are trying to be more progressive, and they're concerned about what they eat.
Yeah.
So yes, it's a lot of that happening. It's a lot of change in attitude. A lot of whites, a lot of blacks. It's all. It's a lot of young people are just different when it comes to this. And so as they have more desires to eat better, because they consider about, they want to look good. This group, they don't like being old, and they don't like this. They don't want that. So. How do you look good? You got to eat good.
Right.
You got to exercise. And those farmers, most of those farmers live to be, I would be probably worse off if I wasn't in the farming, because at least I've been out, you know. If I wasn't doing that, I wouldn't be living as much as I could, because I have stuff in that's hereditary in the family. But at least being in farming, it gives you exercise. When you out there, because I know a lot of farmers up in age, and they out there, and they, you know, physically fit and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that's important.
Yeah, definitely. I'm trying to think of anything else. I don't think I have asked yet.
I'm running my mouth so much that maybe.
No, you covered like a wide variety of topics. That's good. I mean, it's exactly what I wanted. So I guess, like, where do you see the future going now? I mean, not just with your project, but just in general.
I think there'll be more and more people seeking information on how to grow foods, how to eat better. So I think you'll have more farm-to-table, more new people pay a lot of money for farm-to-table dinners. I think you'll have more interest in nutrition. I think it's going to be more things, because it's going to be mandatory, because as the climate does. I was looking in some place over in Europe, and this polar bear was down in the city, and the polar bear was skinny. What is this? And the polar bear is just coming to the city looking for food. That's why you have here where the black and brown bears and all are going into, they leaving the parks because they come in to look for food. So it's going to be more people interested. They're going to have to be. It's no choice. It's going to be, it's because you already see a change in attitude. So hopefully whenever this tape, years from now, some people will be listening to it, because they have an interest in doing something different. And, you know, because eating this processed plastic food, it's not going to work.
Right.
You know, I went to the buffet this morning. Plastic processed food.
You typically eat things from the farm?
I try to, but not always, because of my schedule, and I'm traveling.
Right.
You know, and when you're traveling, you're going to eat plastic, whatever it is. Plastic processed food. I was looking at the food this morning. I was like, look at this stuff.
It's hard to avoid. It's everywhere.
And it's also cost way more. Poor people, you can't expect them to buy organic milk and organic this and that. And when you have a lot of children and you're trying to feed them, how are you going to eat? How are you going to do that? So that's reality. It's going to be a certain segment of the population. And when you want certain organic foods and stuff like that, naturally grown, you have to have the money.
Right.
Because you can't afford a small farmer. If you're producing certain food, you're going to have to sell your eggs for more money. You know, you have to sell your eggs for probably $3, $4 a carton. Well, you can go to Walmart and buy them for 99 cents. That's the difference. So it's going to be a certain segment of the population that's going to be able to do certain things, as always.
Yeah. Do you see people farming for themselves as like the new wave of the future?
You mean it's just the old wave? Because like I said,
the old wave.
We were doing a lot of that stuff. People were in cities, and people had chickens and stuff like that. So you're going to have people going back to that, but it's formalized now that they can get support from the USDA and all that. That's what I was saying. It's formalized.
Was that not the case before?
No,
USDA?
It was just people. Just people out there doing what they did.
Yeah.
USDA just only recently accepted the urban farm. That's been a recent phenomenon.
Yeah.
And the urban farmers get grants and all that kind of stuff. Like, I have high tunnels in the city. I was the first one in that region to have a high tunnel in the city.
A high tunnel?
Yeah. A high tunnel is USDA puts them out. Rural development gets the grants out for them. A high tunnel is like a greenhouse, but it's why it's a high tunnel is because it grows from the ground. Whereas a greenhouse, you can have tables and chairs and put things. Whereas a high tunnel grows straight from the ground. High tunnel. Mm-hmm. I have high tunnels in the city.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. You can get you on. You can get a high tunnel. Mm-hmm. It's called the EQIP, E-Q-U-I-P, EQIP grant. And it comes from rural development. But people have them in their own yards. Mm-hmm.
Really?
Mm-hmm. You can do it.
I'll have to check into that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't do, I have a garden in my own backyard, but I don't do, like, greenhouse or anything.
I'll show you how to do it.
Yeah, that'd be really cool.
You can have a smaller one. You wouldn't have one maybe as big as mine. You may have one from there to there. And, you know, a high tunnel, the purpose of it is to extend the growing season.
I see.
Mm-hmm.
So you can keep growing during the winter and everything?
Well, like, I had to. I just, my tomatoes just died out probably about a week ago, though. So I had green tomatoes in late October.
Is that normal, or is it just because of
high tunnel? Because it got a high tunnel.
I see, okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because a man stopped and was like, "Why? How you still got it?" I'm saying, this is why. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what advice would you give to people currently and maybe in the future who would be interested in being a farmer? Like, how would they, say someone like,
They need to go to their local extension office. They need to understand what are the rules of the county they live in. What support is there that exists? They need to get seeds and save some seeds. Learn how to save seeds, because you can. And people don't even know how to do that. You need to learn how to save seeds. They need to test the soil to see if you even have good soil where you're trying to grow. What's your water source? So you need to do, you need, and it's a bunch of books now out there. You need to read them. And lastly, get with a farmer. Get with somebody that knows how to do it. And they're people. Get with them. Ask questions, like you do.
Mm-hmm.
Ask questions for people who know how to do these things. They're there. They exist. And once you learn, it's like riding a bicycle. You'll be there. Even though I didn't, you know, it was years since I did any kind of work like this. But I knew how to do it because it was in my head. It was in my memory as a child. And that's another thing. When you teach children how to do things, it has more long-lasting effect. When little kids out there with you, they remember it.
Yeah.
They may not go a different way, but they'll remember it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, you remember stuff from your childhood. I do. Though you went into academia and stuff, but
mm-hmm. I know.
Came back around.
Mm-hmm. That's what I'm saying. And, excuse me, it was the best thing I think I could have done, because the rural life, the farm life, is certain peace that comes with that. It's peace that comes with knowing how to grow things and being one with nature and all. That's a peace. And a lot of times, people just are not at peace, especially in big cities. They're just always rushing in. They're not at peace with themselves or with the world around them. You want peace. I do. I was telling Cherry, you can always go to the city. But, you know, living in a place that gives you peace, that's a good thing. And I want peace. So I need to go.
Yeah. All right.
I hope that helped you.
Yes, that's perfect.
Do you have any other questions there?
I don't have anything else. I mean, is there anything you want to add that I didn't ask?
Mm-hmm. No, you need to get you a high tunnel. You need to go to. You got a house?
I rent a house, yes.
But you got some place that somebody got some permanent land you could be on?
Yes. I got my friend of mine who owns. She owns her own house. So.
You need to get with her and get her to apply for a EQIP grant, EQUIP.
Okay.
And she can put her small high tunnel on the property.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Now you have to sign up. This is the time that they do it, and you have to. It goes in order what they give them. Okay. But you can get a small one. She can get you. Not you don't have a
friend of me, yeah, but
she can.